And this is the Imperfect Buddha Podcast, exploring contemporary Buddhism at the edge and at play in the Great Feast of Knowledge. Sponsored by O'Connell Coaching. Visit imperfectbuddha.com coaching if you're interested in exploring the themes that emerge in this podcast and engaging with the challenges of a contemporary spiritual practice. Today we're talking with Tina Rasmussen, and Tina, often with guests, the names are already an interesting start-off point, and I think your surname is kind of interesting. Could you tell us something about it? Does it have a history?
Yes, it's Danish, so I'm a quarter Danish, but I, like many Americans, I'm a lot of things, a quarter Italian, Swiss, French, and German.
Okay.
So I'm basically an American mutt, the way many of us are. Yes, but I was actually very close to my Danish family and my Italian family being very ethnically different. And my grandfather immigrated from Denmark on a boat when he was 16 with $6 in his pocket. Mm. And my grandmother's parents immigrated from Italy.
Wow.
So I'm only a few generations out on that side of the family. Yeah.
Well, it's nice to have that connection then, isn't it? Because so many Americans lose it and then they end up tracing back through the family tree looking for some origin story. But for you, it's still there to some degree.
It is, yeah. All those ancestors spoke their original languages, so I heard those languages and, you know, sang songs in them, which I don't actually know what the words meant, but yes, I was close to my heritage in those, in both the Danish and Italian. So like when I go to Italy, I just love it because I feel so at home there. And it reminds me of my Italian ancestry and Denmark too.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's an interesting aspect of identity, I think, especially, you know, when you get to middle age and onwards. Even for Buddhists, I think, you know, thinking about the role of that kind of those roots, however tangible or intangible they are, can be an interesting process, right?
Right. What does it really all mean, if anything?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So look, Tina, we're going to be talking about practice. I prepared a few questions and there are a few topics that I'd like to explore with you. I had a listen to a conversation you had with Buddha at the gas pump. I don't know how old that conversation was, but I found it interesting for a variety of reasons, and it got me thinking about a couple of themes, in particular generational differences and some of the challenges in branching out beyond Buddhism and exploring different practice traditions. So we'll see what your thoughts are about that. Let's talk a little bit about your current relationship with practice, though. I mean, you've been at meditation, you've been at Buddhism, you've been at other practices too, for quite a long time. How would you evaluate where you are today in your relationship with things like meditation, sitting practice, and paying attention to your own, I don't know what language you'd like to use, but maybe maturation or continuing growth, development, and understanding of what it means to be human and what it means to be a practitioner of some sort?
Yeah, well, I had the good fortune to start meditating at the age of 13. So it's been a long time. It's been many decades. And I still meditate every day. I've meditated every day without missing a day for 30 years, or maybe it's more than that. I think it's more than that at this point. Because I find that, well, one thing, I like it. I mean, that as a bottom line, I enjoy doing it. But there's something about that consistency. I mean, it's changed a lot over the years, what it means, what it is. But I do feel that regardless of where one is in their trajectory, I think it's still a beneficial thing to do daily. But my practice, you know, I've done so much deep retreat practice that at some point, really, the growing edge for me is what's happening off the cushion and how much can I live from what I've realized. So that's really the growing edge of my practice at this point is that. Not that I don't still do long retreats or sit daily, but at which I do both of those, you know, regularly, in addition to teaching. But it's the integration and the embodiment for me that's really my growing edge.
And if you've managed to sit that consistently, which is quite a feat considering life is always full of ups and downs, I mean, you must have made a few sacrifices along the way, right?
Yeah, lots of them. I mean, part of what I think has enabled me to do that, and for most of those years, I worked full-time in an extremely demanding job in the business world. So it's not like I've done this, oh, she's a Buddhist teacher, it's easy. No, you know, until really, I'm still doing a little tiny bit of work in the business world even now, but there were decades where I was working 40 to 60 hours a week with senior executives where I'd have to get up at 4 a.m. and drive for an hour and sit in the parking lot and meditate before I went in to lead a day-long event with 25 very high-functioning, demanding executives, you know. And so I did it in the car, in the parking lot. Or when I worked in downtown San Francisco, I had to ride public transportation. Again, I had to get up early, walk with my dress and my, you know, athletic shoes and my briefcase to the office. I would do it on public transit. And, you know, it's not, a lot of people think the only way you can sit is if you have the perfect, pristine, quiet conditions with your altar in front of you and, you know, none of your family members around. Well, that's great. And it is nice to be able to meditate like that. That's part of why we go on retreat, is to have those conditions. But, you know, if you limit it to that, you're going to find days when you can't. You just don't have time. So that's where, to me, learning to meditate in different situations, it just helps. I didn't realize at the time, but now it's helped me with the whole off-the-cushion integration, because I don't have to have pristine conditions to have my inner experience be available. You know, and so that, when you say sacrifice, part of it is I sacrificed ideal conditions. And then all the long retreat practice I did, of course, there were a lot of sacrifices involved in taking a year-long solo retreat and, you know, things like that. So, yeah, there's been a lot of sacrifice involved, but I don't really think of it like that.
Yeah, good. And I think you're picking up on a theme there, which is important, especially in long-term practice, which is examining and coming to terms with some of the expectations and ideals that we have and that we often project onto practice. That can certainly be an obstacle, I think, both in terms of people evolving their sense of what they're doing, whether it's on cushion or off cushion, but also finding the kind of joy and pleasure and discipline that you're alluding to in what you're sharing. But talking about obstacles more broadly, I think it's one of those things that it would be helpful for everybody to hear more about from teachers. I mean, I think we're still living in the kind of the trails of certain ideals of the teacher as being impeccable or perfect in some way, or not having their own struggles and strife. Would you be happy to talk about perhaps a couple of the larger obstacles you've come up against in your practicing life and that you've managed to overcome to some degree?
Yeah. Well, are you meaning obstacles externally to practicing or obstacles internally, or which?
Either.
Yeah, either. Okay. Yeah. Well, externally, it's probably the one that most people have, which is I can't find time to do it. You know, I mean, I work with people all the time who are trying to really establish a daily practice and they're well motivated, but they just can't do it, or it's not a good sitting every day. And so then it's like, well, I didn't have a very good sitting yesterday. Maybe today I'll just skip it. And now all of a sudden, 2 or 3 days have gone by and they haven't practiced. And so, I mean, to me, that's one of the things I think early on that I got. Part of why I started meditating every day, I was in my late 20s, and I just found that the days I meditated were better. There was something about them that was better than the days I didn't. That's really what it came down to. And so I really resolved to practice every day, regardless of whether it was, quote, a good sitting or not. And I think that is, like I will often in my talks talk about this being like brushing your teeth. I mean, would you really go 3 or 4 days without brushing your teeth? You know, you don't look in the mirror while you're brushing your teeth and go, wow, today's really a great toothbrushing. Maybe I'll do this again tomorrow. You know, I mean, we're just doing it every day because it's good for us. And now we know through the neuroscience, you know, between 200 and 500 studies a year on meditation, it's good for you. You know, so that's to me, we didn't have the science back then, but that's part of it for me was when I got that this is good for me. And whether I do it every day isn't going to be based on, oh, did I have a good sitting every single day? You know, part of it, it's like exercise, like lifting weights. There's going to be some days where it's going to hurt a little bit or it's going to be harder. And that's part of what's reprogramming our consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's having to lift the weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're talking about science. I mean, this is one of the things that was in the description of you on the Buddha the Gas Pump interview, was that you were a participant in one of the Yale neuroscience studies on meditation. What came out of that study and what did they discover about Tina? What did and maybe what do you make of the results of that?
It wasn't like, oh, let's study Tina. I was part of a study of advanced meditators. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, to be clear about what it is, I'm actually going to my website right now to look it up. And it is on there, downloadable, if anybody wants to actually look at it. I'll read you the title. Effortless Awareness, Using Real-Time Neurofeedback to Investigate Correlates of Posterior Cingulate Cortex Activity in Meditator's Self-Report. And then basically my take on it, and this was done by Dr. Judson Brewer, who is now at the Center for Mindfulness at UMass. He was at Yale then. He was the director there. But basically, I took away that the study was about how concentration meditation deactivates the sense of the me through skillful, balanced effort. That was, I think, maybe the subtitle or something. Or maybe that was my take on the subtitle. But when you do a study like that, like at the afterwards, I said, you know, how was it? You know, I mean, what happened? I didn't really know even what they were researching when it was done. Mm-hmm. And they said, we can't really say, but basically it proved our hypothesis. Mm-hmm. That was all they really told me.
Okay.
So, I mean, anybody who wants to see the article, it was about the activation and deactivation of the posterior cingulate cortex, the PCC. And some people think that's the center of the sense of self. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that's kind of cool, actually, that I was in a study that shows that meditation can, in part, or, you know, contribute to the deactivation of the sense of the me, which is really what Buddhism is all about. Mm-hmm. But they had meditators from all traditions. It wasn't just Buddhist meditators. Hmm. So what happened. And I had the whole EEG set up on my head. I got a picture of it on my website. And it was great to be able to contribute to the understanding because, you know, it's harder for them to find advanced meditators than it is to find, you know, newer, beginning or intermediate. There's just more people to pick from.
Yeah. Well, another thing that you're perhaps better known for is your work on, well, your collaboration on a book on jhanas and jhanic states and concentration states. Now, one reason for mentioning this is because it gives us an insight into what I think is a great contribution you've made. I have a copy of the book myself, and it's a very interesting introduction for beginning and middling practitioners into thinking about concentration states and why they might want to get involved in developing their relationship with them as well. Concentration is one phrase that it might be worth unpacking briefly. Do you continue to teach that kind of practice? And what do you think are some of the benefits of spending serious time developing the capacity to focus your attention and develop deeper states of concentration for extended periods of time?
I do still teach this regularly. I both online and in person at, you know, day-long talks, retreats. So yes, I do teach it. And there's a lot of benefits. I mean, for one thing, the Buddha did this practice himself, not only leading up to his awakening and enlightenment, but after. So you got to wonder, why would somebody who's fully enlightened keep doing a practice? Well, because he kept recommending it to people over and over. And at the moment of death, when he could have chosen to do anything, this was the practice he was doing. So we can't know why, but just if we think of him as a role model, that's fairly compelling. It is to me, at least. So why? Why did he think it was so important and talk about it in 60 to 80% of the suttas, which is what I've been told by scholars? Why did he recommend doing that practice? Well, now that I've been teaching for 15 years, I can see why in students. And with the neuroscience, this is in the category of focused attention meditation. Basically, what it's doing is a few things. One is that we are deconditioning. You're coming back to one object of awareness and turning away from everything else, not being aversive to everything else, but we're building a muscle of the capacity to direct attention at something and not go off compulsively into our thought patterns. So that's the first thing we can see when we try to do concentration, a focused attention type of meditation, is that we will see whatever our compulsive thought patterns are that are so ingrained in our consciousness. We have so many synapses that have been run over trillions of times that are now very thick. Going over those same patterns, we're going to see what they are. So that's one thing. We're going to see our, in Buddhism, hindrances and defilements quickly. And by just coming back, we're deconditioning those grooves in our consciousness. So whatever we're finding that when we sit, we're compulsively going into those thought patterns, we're basically challenging that. Now with the neuroscience, we know that we're actually making those neural pathways thinner. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just think about a trail that was walked over, you know, 100,000 times, and now it's only walked over 10 times. It's going to, you know, not be as deep. Grass is going to start filling that in. So this is really what's happening. And then potentially we can, there's three different levels of concentration that I won't get into. But as that becomes more, as the mind stream becomes unified, it can become laser-like. And in more advanced stages, it can become laser-like to the point that it cuts through our normal perception of reality into the mystery. So just from a practical standpoint, you know, with our tech devices and all of the things that are actually changing our gray matter, which is a little scary that we're all guinea pigs that we haven't signed up to be in this experiment called constant tech stimulation. Mm-hmm. This is offsetting that, which is just practical, and also bringing serenity. I mean, the word samatha actually means both concentration and serenity, and people often forget that. Mm-hmm. But it's deconditioning. We're basically getting a software upgrade, and we're the programmer and the program. Mm-hmm. Just by coming back to this object, we're deconditioning those compulsive thought patterns. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the other part of the samatha practice is that we're really, it's not a practice where we're investigating the body and the thoughts. We're not investigating. We're directing our consciousness to the formless, to the unconditioned mystery that's beyond the body and the personality. So that in itself has a lot of benefits in terms of not only transforming the personality, but accessing the transcendent nature that we are at our depth.
Well, that's an interesting leap off point then towards the other topic I wanted to get into with you. How shall I say this? Let me start from here. There are two things that come to my mind in listening to what you were saying, and one is the interest or the capacity of the younger generation to engage with these kinds of practices, especially as you were pointing to, with the technology having the impact it's having on attention span and levels of concentration in the general population. So that's certainly interesting. I kind of get this feeling that at some point there's going to be a proper revolt and reaction, and people are going to start sort of hunting out or hunting down new kinds of spaces where they can detach from that constant stimulation. And maybe there'll be a revival of traditional concentration style meditation practices, or at least something else. I don't know. Culture's interesting in that way. But the other element that comes to my mind in listening to what you were saying was this this description of what we are, right? Which is one of those questions that's kind of avoided in early Buddhism. In later Buddhism, we end up with concepts such as Buddha nature, true nature, or the ground of being, this kind of thing. That's led to a sort of closeness between Buddhism and Advaita or Neo-Advaita in the West, in particular in America. And I think it's something that we've seen a lot with the Boomer generation. I'm kind of interested in how that generation is managing some of the potential conflict between those two different traditions. And I'd like to share the work of Bhikkhu Bodhi. Are you familiar with him?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he's quite interesting. I have different kinds of conversations with different kinds of people, and some people think he's an extremely conservative practitioner and teacher of Buddhism who's perhaps overly conservative to some degree. But he's quite adamant that there is an unresolvable conflict between non-dual systems of practice and thought, and then the earlier schools of Buddhism. And he picks up on something which I find interesting, which is this desire for a unifying principle. To some degree, we could define a lot of the 1960s generation, their relationship with religion and spirituality and practice more broadly, as being characterized by a profound desire for unity. Buddhism, though, challenges us with this idea of non-self or no-self. Could you talk to that for a moment? What's your relationship with those two opposing views, there being no true essential self, no necessary ground of being, and the fact that there may appear to be something of that kind in these deeper states of concentration, or just in the process of being a long-term practitioner and teacher?
Yeah, well, I am aware of the difference between Theravadan Buddhism and the later, the Mahayana, the Vajrayana, where they at least have something, Buddha nature, and the idea of it there being something that's more describable, whereas the Buddha just said what it wasn't, mostly because I think he didn't want people to conceptualize. I mean, I'm making that up, but scholars would have a better sense of it. I like the different perspectives that are out there, so I don't take exception with somebody like Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is conservative and traditional. I mean, he's, a monastic. Most monastics are more traditional, although there's a range still within that community as well. For me, what I speak from experience. So just to be clear, I'm not a scholar. I'm not a historian. I speak from experience. So what I'm going to say is from experience, that they're the traditions, the Eastern traditions, and in particular Buddhism, emphasizes emptiness as the leading characteristic, especially in Theravadan Buddhism, but all of Buddhism, whereas the Western traditions focus more on unity. And so if you this is unity and the Western traditions being theistic and so on. So this is, the big departure point. But when you start actually, for a person who can who experiences non-duality, there are, and I have a whole talk on this that I'm just starting to flesh out, this teaching called Dimensions of Non-Duality, where in Buddhism, we actually have formless dimensions. All, as far as I know, at least the Theravadan and the Vajrayana lineages have this acknowledgement of this. And there are different ways of experiencing formless realms or non-duality. Like I feel that in the Diamond Approach, they have an excellent map of the different ways of experiencing non-duality that can explain the differences between traditions. Because they're all pointing at non-duality that is something beyond the sense of the me that we can know that we are. And some of those experiences, one dimension is, two of the dimensions are more about emptiness, and three are more about unity. So it's kind of like the blind man and the elephant. They're all pointing to an elephant, but one's feeling a tail and says, no, it's a rope. And the other says, is rubbing the side of the elephant saying, no, it's a sandpapery wall. And the others say, no, it's a suction cup, you know, the one with the trunk. So who's right and who's wrong? So to me, this is really, there's a way to understand the fact that different traditions are pointing to different dimensions of non-duality and focusing on that and not the others. And even within Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism is focusing on a dimension that I would call the absolute, where there's just nothing. It's the ultimate dimension that is the deepest, that it has no, that is the dimension that other dimensions emerge from. And Tibetan Buddhism is focusing on what I would call the non-conceptual and the pure presence dimensions, which are more, a little bit closer. Pure presence is more about unity, which is more in Hinduism. And the non-conceptual is the clear, more Rigpa-like experience, where it isn't about the black, but you can function from it more, which is why in Tibetan Buddhism, we have eyes open, we have more functioning, whereas in Theravadin, eyes are closed. There's more of a monastic tradition. I mean, all of this to me explains why there are differences in understanding, and nobody's really wrong. Everybody's right and nobody's wrong from that perspective. In a certain way, mm-hmm. You know, so this, I mean, this is a long answer to your question, but this is how I understand it. And all of this is coming from my own experience. Mm-hmm. I'm not speaking theoretically. These are the formless dimensions in the jhanas, and also they are ways of experiencing non-duality without jhana, because mm-hmm. non-duality is available in any moment. Right now it's available. We don't have to have concentration. The advantage of jhanas, which are concentrative absorptions, is that they're stable and repeatable. And I think that's why the Buddha thought so highly of them.
If there's a certain expectation of certain kinds of experiences or certain kinds of possibilities, then I think that shapes actually the kind of curvature of the subjective as we practice. And I think there is something radical, perhaps, that's still missing from the kind of view you're sharing, that maybe Bhikkhu Bodhi's pointing to, maybe not, of course. Certainly, if we talk about experiences, it's almost unanswerable as a question. But I think there are certain tendencies that have been present among certain approaches to Buddhism and spiritual practice more broadly that reflect wider culture. And one of those elements is, well, it is reflected in that idea of the desire for unity, which is a resistance to ending or ceasing of existence. And I wonder if to some degree that non-duality, or the idea that there is some kind of ultimate nature that we can discover and relax into and be, could also end up becoming a way of avoiding the raw experience of actually finding that there is no true me anywhere in there. Right, that actually emptiness is empty, and that ceasing is the ending and ceasing of things. Certainly, I would agree with you that out of that, something continues, in the sense that we are still here physically, consciousness is still there, and there's a sense of Matthew or Tina. I think there may be some kind of collective resistance to that experience of the other, of the kind of the unpleasantness of saying, actually, there is nothing. And there are moments of fear or discomfort or terror that can emerge in seeing that vacuousness or that black hole that can be there too, in those deep, dark recesses of uncovering these patterns of me-ness and I-ness. Does any of that make sense to you? Do you have any thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you asked about no self in the other question. To me, yeah. No self and non-duality are a little different, because no self is really about mm-hmm. the internal experience of what am I, and seeing the emptiness of the cycle, you know, basically seeing that the me that we thought we were is a mental construct. And yes, when people, like with the jhanas, they are non-dual experiences, and so they aren't awakening, but they're helping a person to get acclimated mm-hmm. to awakening, basically. And so the me goes dormant, and what I found consistently is that when people get close to that threshold, fear comes up. And because the me is basically made up of defense mechanisms, self-images, and beliefs. And without those, when the me goes dormant, if those aren't present, it feels psychologically extremely, extremely vulnerable. And so this could be somebody who's been seeking enlightenment for 30 years, and they're still going to feel fear when that happens, until there's enough. It's like going to 14,000 feet, you know, or to a high altitude. We have to get acclimated, and then at some point we're used to it and it's no big deal. That's what being without the me is like. And so there's a natural process, which is to me part of the compassion of the nature of reality, is that it doesn't usually happen until somebody has enough trust that we can't force the me to surrender and relax. You can't like make yourself relax. It's impossible, because if there's a forcing, there's no relaxing. So there has to be enough trust that it relaxes on its own. And that comes through experience, that the me can be dormant and it's okay. So that is no self to me. Non-duality applies to that too, but it also applies to everything in one's experience, which would mean the outside world, other people, all phenomena one is experiencing. That is a much, much broader application also between non-duality, between what one would consider to be oneself and the ground. It's manifesting everything. So that is a much, much bigger jump than no self, which normally would be the first thing somebody would experience, would be getting oriented to that feeling, that an experience that the me that one thought one was basically a mental construct. And so, you know, this is where, yeah, there's fear. And but I don't see, again, my understanding, which includes that there are dimensions of non-duality that one can experience. There is a lot more comfort with dimensions that are more about presence, which have to do with unity, than those that are about that the mystery of the emptiness, that's basically like antimatter almost, or the void, is much more, it's a harder approach, because that even it's if you think of a black hole, even concepts get absorbed by that. And that's, I think, why the Buddha said it wouldn't describe it, because even concepts become, like, again, if you imagine a black hole, they just get absorbed, so that there's really nothing there. But this is where, to me, at the deepest, if you imagine a coin with two sides, that mystery of the ground is the potentiality from which everything manifests. So in a way, you could say it is unity. So to me, emptiness and unity are really two sides of one coin. And if one only has an experience of one or the other, it's incomplete. So I hear what you're saying about, yeah, approaching unity is a way easier approach to the ego self than emptiness. Way easier.
Well, I think there's another risk there as well. And maybe you'll have something to say to this, which is that because of the fear and the terror that can emerge when you confront the loss of that reference point, I think there is a tendency, or there may be a tendency, to fill that void with some kind of idea of a true self or of something similar that comes under the title of true self, because it acts as a way to avoid having to stay there or to spend more time in that experience of selflessness. There might be a tension there that plays out within the relationship that many Westerners have between Buddhism and Neo-Advaita, between non-dualism and the lack of an essential self some place. But let's do this. I do want to talk to you a little bit about some of the attraction that's there, I think, for many older teachers towards both Advaita or Neo-Advaita and Buddhism. Can I ask you a slightly different question? Why do you think so many boomer generation American Buddhist teachers have been and continue to be drawn towards simultaneously Buddhism and Neo-Advaita? Why do you think that's the case?
Well, I'm wondering, you know, you may be describing Neo-Advaita as something that is about unity. And I don't see, like, one of the very popular teachers is Adyashantu, who came from a Zen background. So I don't see that there's a huge gap between how he talks about things and Buddhism. I mean, he was in Zen for, you know, he's probably done 100 Zen sessions. So he's not exactly a Hindu, you know. I mean, so you may be, when you're using that term, you may be implying that it automatically has unity as at its core. And I don't think, like, that's not the experience, I don't think, of a lot of people who cross over between Buddhism and that movement, like the science of non-duality. You know, it's a hybrid of lots of different orientations. But if you take someone like Adyashanti, you know, he's very Buddhist in his own experience and understanding. I mean, the person who authorized him to teach was a Buddhist teacher. So, you know, so that's where I don't necessarily see a huge gap. You take someone like Gangaji, she's from a Hindu lineage. But really, when people are talking about it, there's, I think, again, because in my understanding, for example, in Buddhism, I'll just tell you the four formless dimensions that to me are non-duality within Buddhism: base of boundless space, base of boundless consciousness, which to me feels like unity, base of nothingness, and the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Those are the four formless dimensions, which I feel are non-dual, all of them. And the base of boundless consciousness feels a whole lot like unity. So it's not that that's not within Buddhism. It's just not the deepest dimension. So, you know, I think you may be drawing a little bit of an artificial, like, line that is that isn't quite such a line. It's actually a lot more fluid, even within Buddhism. Because if somebody experiences, say, for example, somebody has a non-dual experience and they're popping into the dimension of infinite consciousness, that's going to feel a lot more like presence and unity, like more of a Hindu-ish experience. And they're still within Buddhism. It's not like there's different dimensions of non-duality based on your tradition. There's reality. And, you know, different lineages and different traditions are pointing at different aspects of reality. But that doesn't mean that just because I'm a Buddhist, I might not happen to pop into the base of boundless consciousness. So what if I'm a Buddhist and my teachers are all saying, no, you're supposed to be experiencing emptiness. But really what I happen to be popping into is the base of boundless consciousness. It's going to feel a lot more like unity or presence. So to me, it's like the idea that people are searching it out because they can't tolerate the emptiness. That may be true because the emptiness is really hard to tolerate. But they could actually be having a genuine experience that's non-dual. It just doesn't fit within the main, you know, Buddhism's feeling the trunk and describing the trunk of the elephant, and the person happens to be touching the side of the elephant. Doesn't mean that their experience isn't valid.
Okay, yeah.
So that's how I would say it. You know, I mean, this is in the formless dimensions are, you know, pretty well detailed in traditional Buddhism. So they're not, you know, I think the idea that they're somehow deluded and they're trying to find unity to avoid emptiness. Again, that may be true, but what people who are experiencing that are experiencing may actually be valid even within Buddhism, even within Theravadin Buddhism.
Cuckoo, as they say in Italy. Or, hey there, if you're American, and you're right, mate, if you're from the UK. Look, really, how many of these episodes have you listened to? How much have you got out of these conversations and all that hard work we put into them? If you've gained value from the podcast, go ahead and make a donation. Give something back. Call it Dana if it makes it more palatable. You know it's the right thing to do. We get so much from the internet for free that we too often forget the hardworking men and women are giving up their time, energy, and effort to make it for you. None of it is free. And that includes this podcast. Visit imperfectbuddha.com, scroll down on the right for the donation button, and do your part. Thank you. It's all interesting, and I guess one of the things that I've always been interested in personally is just how spiritual practices, whether Buddhist or otherwise, can be put to a different range of uses, right? We can employ them in ways that they're presented, that a teacher gives, that a sutra or a more contemporary text might indicate, but we can also put them to other uses as well. And I think it's interesting where people get lost or get stuck or find themselves in difficulty or the comfort point where a person says, I don't want to go beyond that, I'm going to stay here because it's perhaps too much. And I think it's interesting to think about that both for the individual practitioner, but also for groups and even the collective, right? For the American Buddhists or Western Buddhists or Buddhists worldwide and for non-Buddhists too. But time is never enough with these things. And I do want to ask you one question because you've been using a couple of terms throughout. They're both still problematic. I don't know what you think about it, but I'd like to give you a very small challenge. You've mentioned awakening, enlightenment's popped up too, and I think you're probably well aware that these terms can mean many, many different things. I think it's quite useful sometimes to try and reframe them or come up with another way of describing them without using either word. So if you were to describe to somebody who's a little bit doubtful or suspicious or critical of the whole idea of enlightenment or awakening, could you describe it in another way to them that might make sense?
Yeah, to me, awakening, there is a difference between the two and how I use the terms. Awakening is the, and there are stages, and I do use the Theravadin model. I think it's the best, most easy to use one out there of the stages where there's four. So just to say that. So awakening is the when the ego self is seen through at a level that is permanent and doesn't reverse, even if the person becomes re-identified with the ego self, that they never really believe it's true. And that in Buddhism would be stream entry. So that's, to me, awakening. People will have tastes of the ego self going dormant, which would be tastes of non-duality, can be very momentary, like in Dzogchen, that's really what they're going for. And in Zen, they're going for that, is these tastes And then the taste, we get comfortable with it. The taste can become more prolonged if one's concentration is strong enough. If you don't have the concentration, you're never going to have anything stable happening. So this is where the samatha practice becomes, when you become a more advanced practitioner, gets even more important, because it's not going to become stable without that faculty of our awareness. So that would be, awakening is basically when one really knows. It's not an experience, it's a shift of identity. So if it's like I'm having awakening experiences or non-dual experiences, that's tastes, and those are really important for somebody's unfoldment, but that's not awakening. Those are experiences. It's when it becomes permanent. And, you know, that could happen through cessation, which is the traditional Theravada understanding. In other traditions, cessation isn't necessarily the way it can happen. It can happen other ways. But to me, regardless of how it happens, that's a marker which changes one's perception of reality permanently. That would be awakening in my understanding. And then I feel there are stages that happen that correspond with the Theravada model, that where this deepens and one's the amount, and this is where the embodiment becomes so important, because if you aren't working your personality material, there's just too much personality material even after awakening for it to really ever become stable without working that. I think that's historically part of the problem why we have scandals and other things, is people think that the first stage of awakening is like, oh, I've arrived, this is it. And it's not, as we can see from the many scandals. I mean, like I've said, one of the things I really have thought about, like, okay, that person who slept with their student, how many thousands of times did they have to have that thought before they acted on it? And it never occurred to them that they needed to talk to someone or work this and go, gosh, I wonder why I keep thinking about doing something that's going to cause harm and is a power abuse. They never once thought to go and talk to somebody and get some help, because they had this mistaken belief that just because they had a legitimate awakening experience that all their personality material is gone. And then they had to shore that up by pretending. It's total spiritual bypassing, even after awakening. So, I mean, to me, that's awakening, and there are stages that I could get into. Enlightenment is when there's no personality material left at all. I think that's extremely rare. I don't think I've ever met any teacher who I feel is at that stage, who's living.
Well, the second one is a tricky one, and we could probably spend time talking about that, but that's, we don't have that. But just to go back to what you were saying about teachers abusing students, I think there are two other points always worth mentioning there. The awakening or no awakening, whatever we want to call it, I think awakening probably doesn't mean very much if a person behaves in that way afterwards. I think the person is clearly suffering from delusion and lacks compassion and basic humanity, but it's also a social and a cultural problem, right? Because if there's a sangha or a community of people around this person that are not picking up on this kind of dysfunctional behavior, the problem goes beyond him or her. And I guess we're seeing some of the consequences of that as some sanghas are waking up to the fact that they can't invest in this idea of the perfect infallible teacher. But there it is. I don't know if you've got 2 minutes, and maybe I can ask you one final question, because you talk about the ego self. And I think, you know, if you're going to talk about transcending that to some degree, you have to define that too. Could you do that in 2 minutes for us, Tina? Or would that be asking too much?
I'll try. I've got a clock in front of me, so I'll try to keep it short. Yeah, the ego self is the it's a psychological construct that's necessary for the human experience, in my view. I don't think it's a mistake. As far as we know, every human's had it, including the Buddha. So I think it's more healthy to see it as a stage of human development that isn't an endpoint necessarily, that we can go beyond it. But for self-reflective capacity, we need it. Otherwise, we'd be like animals who may be one with everything, but they don't know it. We can know it. That's what's unique about humans. And now through psychology in the last 100 years, we can actually see how it functions, how it's structured in a more mechanical way. It's made up of self-images of what I am, defense mechanisms that got instituted, a lot of them prior to the age of 6, like kids 2 or 3, they don't have a me. That's why you have to say, mommy's going to the store. You can't say, I'm going to the store, because they don't know they can't really distinguish yet who is you and who is themselves. You know, so these defense mechanisms get put in place that psychologically help us feel that we will be okay. Things that get rewarded or not rewarded, punished by in our environment, we shape to become that. And then those become part of the me, and then beliefs. So those are all the things that make up the me. And also there's the inner critic that keeps the me in place, because it's reinforcing internally our compliance with those self-images, defenses. So if we start breaking free from them, it'll say, no, do that. And there's even a spiritual superego who makes us try to look like, when we get through the first layer of the ego, then we get a spiritual ego and superego. That means I'm supposed to look like this as a spiritual practitioner, and it'll force me to keep conforming to that, but it's still basically egoic. Because, I mean, if you look at spiritual groups, it's so interesting. They all look similar to founders. Well, and if you deviate too much from that, you don't get the social support. You get criticized. But the ground of being isn't picking a religion. So there's whole new layers to work through once we get through the basic egoic material. But yeah, I probably went over my 2 minutes, 3 minutes, sorry. but yeah, that's what the me is made up of. And it's there because psychologically, it's all layered on the survival instinct. To have a human experience, we have a body. The body has to survive for us to have a human experience. We don't have any survival instinct, the body isn't going to survive. And we are in a physical world where the body can be harmed. And what happens is our psychological self gets laminated to that, so that when our psychological self gets threatened, we feel like we're going to die. And that's why we defend ourselves. That's why we defend it so extremely, because they become almost like one. And all this has to come under the enlightenment drive if we're really going to wake up. The enlightenment drive has to become stronger than the survival instinct.
And there it is. And there it is. that's now 3.5 minutes, Tina.
Okay, sorry. Sorry, Matthew.
No worries. So you've been listening to a conversation with Tina Rasmussen, and the book that I mentioned before, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with, is Practicing the Jhanas. And that was actually published way back in 2009, but it's definitely worth a look if you're interested in the topic. And Tina's website is Luminous Mind Sangha, where you can find out more about her work and other conversations too. Tina, thank you for giving up a bit of your time to speak with us today.
Thanks for the invitation, Matthew. I enjoyed the conversation and appreciate the challenges too. It's good to have a robust dialogue.
This is a quick tag on note just to say thank you to those very kind folks who heard the message, got the call, and did their part to donate to the project. That is the Imperfect Buddha podcast. Your donations are appreciated. You know who you are, and we are very grateful to you. More for the generosity than the money itself. You know what it's like. It's nice to be part of a community where people actually give back. There's an extra song as a reward to all of you. Yes, I know it's been a while since I put music on, but hey, these are COVID times.
And oddly enough, for some of us, that has meant working more than ever, even while locked up at home. Anyway, this is a song from a group that I fell in love with back in the 90s, one of the great trip-hop groups of the time, Funky Porcini, and this is from the album The Ultimate Empty Million Pounds. And the track is called Tears of Joy. That's T-I-E-R-S. Catch you next time.
Generally, the people consider themselves devils, surrounded by a lot of angels, causing them enormous problems.